Are we creating a product that people love and are willing to tell their friends about? Are we creating a brand, a global brand that is synonymous with the outdoors, that is rooted in inclusivity and accessibility? And again, there's no finish line for any of these things. So it's really just like, so long as we're making forward progress and it feels like we're moving in the right direction, that's really the only way I know how to calibrate success on this journey.
How do you become the iPhone app of the year? No, there's not one of 10. There aren't 20 of them. There's one out of all the millions of apps on the App Store. There's just one iPhone app of the year. Hello and welcome to Growth Masterminds. My name is John Katsir. Today we're chatting with the CEO of an app that has well over 10 million installs. I say well over 10 million because they don't totally disclose. It's a private company. I know it's over 10 million just on Android. It's got to be millions and millions on iOS, but I don't have exact numbers there. They have 90% five-star reviews. It makes well over $5 million a month in in-app purchases, according to Apptopia estimates. It has great App Store and Google Play ranking, about 7x better user retention than the average app. And yes, was the iPhone app of the year for 2023. I'm talking about AllTrails, and we have their CEO, Ron Schneiderman, on with us today. Welcome, Ron.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, super pumped to have you. Your PR team pitched me. It's got to be a couple months ago. We couldn't make something happen. It didn't work for everything that I was doing and you were doing. But I saw that you were the iPhone app of the year. And I thought, need to have that person on Growth Masterminds and understand, hey, what the heck goes into that? First of all, congratulations.
Thank you.
What does that mean? What does it mean to you to be called iPhone app of the year?
You said it earlier, there's 2 million apps in the App Store, and there are thousands of incredible apps that are changing people's lives across every dimension. And so to be recognized and to be rewarded by arguably the most influential tech company the world has ever seen, and certainly the most design forward. And when you think about Apple, you think of excellence. It means a lot. There's not a lot of third-party validation in software development. So for us, it feels like our Pulitzer Prize, our Academy Award, our Super Bowl, all rolled up. And to be able to share that with the team, as I'm sure most of your listeners know, software development is a grind. It's a grind. And so much of it's not very glamorous. And it's just oftentimes it just feels like this uphill grind. And so to be able to share it with every single person involved in the company, right? Every single employee outside of just product development and engineering too, customer support, marketing, data integrity, like every single function had a part in getting this. That's a really wonderful thing to be able to celebrate together and share with our board, share with our investors. That's a really wonderful thing. But there's this other layer underneath it all. When I really think about this question, it's a good question. And I think it's that. Again, across all the different ways that apps are improving people's lives right now, and there's so much cool innovation happening within the App Store ecosystem. The fact that Apple singled us out, to me, is just this like this recognition and this validation and this support of our mission, you know, specifically like using technology to get people outside. All of the great health benefits that come from people spending more time outside and all of the great societal benefits that come from community spending more time outside and reconnecting with nature. The fact that Apple sees that, recognizes the importance of it, and is willing to put their weight behind our mission and their wind in our sails, that really means everything to us.
Amazing. And thank you, by the way, for at the end of that, talking a little bit about what AllTrails does. I just assumed that because I know AllTrails. I have AllTrails on my phone. The name tells you a little bit about what the app does, right? But it's about finding trails in your neighborhood, which is not always easy, especially if you're American and you move every 2-3 years to some new place. Where's a cool trail? And you can find a trail. You see how hard it is. Get anecdotes from people who've been on it, some pictures, all that stuff. It's a cool app, subscription for higher value and all that stuff. So thank you for that thoughtful response. And I love how, like you said, it's validation for the journey for the entire team. I've been in the startup world. I've spent 3 years working 70-hour weeks, traveling every other week. and some validation, your Pulitzer Prize, your Super Bowl. That's amazing to be able to share with all the team who don't, you're always in the grind. Even as a CEO, you're in the grind and you don't always see the mountain peak, just like when you're hiking. I remember one time I was hiking in Utah. I kept thinking, there's the peak. No, there's the peak. No, and this will be familiar for hikers. Anyways, to come back to it, let's go back to the very beginning. What did success look like to you at that point?
I took over from the founder in 2015 when it was a 6-person company. And the handshake agreement was to try and grow it a little bit and sell it. That was what I signed up for. And so the thought was it'd be like a quick flip, put in a growth playbook, unlock some potential and sell it. And so in 2015, when I was starting, we calibrated on like, it'd be really cool if we could sell it for 30, 40 million bucks. That'd be great. We'd be stoked. And then the more time I spent here, I grew up on the trail. My dad was a geologist. When I was 22, I drove from the Bay Area up to Alaska with 3 friends. We just camped every night for 6 weeks. I love the outdoors. It's a core part of my life. I have 3 kids. I'm raising them on the trail. And so to be able to spend my time and energy on something that means so much to me personally and to my family personally, that's a very unique opportunity. And so as we were going through, so that was the early definition of success. But the more time I spent here, that changed quickly. And the goalposts always move. There's always those false summits. But I can definitively say that success is not the finish line here. I'll be sad at the finish line. There's nothing else I'd rather do. So the way that I think about success is just really through the lens of growth. Are we making forward progress? Are we getting more people into our community? Are we getting more people to spend more time outside? Are we generating incremental momentum? Are we creating a product that people love and are willing to tell their friends about? Are we creating a brand, a global brand that is synonymous with the outdoors, that is rooted in inclusivity and accessibility? And again, there's no finish line for any of these things. So it's really just like, so long as we're making forward progress and it feels like we're moving in the right direction, that's really the only way I know how to calibrate success on this journey.
Love it. Well, so it's interesting here that you were brought on for quick fix, turnaround, growth jolt, and then sell it. You're here still. You anticipate being here for the foreseeable future. You're loving it. But let's talk about your growth and some of the key decisions that made your success profitable. What were some of the key decisions that you made that ignited growth?
I tend to think of all, I've been here 8.5 years now, right? So I tend to think of it in terms of like chapters, like these distinct phases over the course of our history. I think one of the first ones in 2015, 2016, when we knew, again, the goal was to try and sell it, we weren't profitable. So we were at this inflection point, whether we go and raise money. And I'd done the VC thing before at a previous startup, and we made an explicit, a conscious decision to not go raise funds and instead focus on getting to profitability because we wanted to be able to control our own destiny, right? Anytime you bring on a third party, it adds complications in terms of like when it's time to sell, to whom, when, how much, everything else. So because we chose not to raise money, we instead had to just work our asses off, just relentlessly march towards getting to profitability and self-fund our growth. And so that became a core part of our DNA. Again, focus on not just product market fit, but product channel fit and organic sustainable growth, self-funding our own growth, fiscal discipline. That's all just is a core part of who we are because we had to develop that muscle during these like really early years. So I think that was definitely one of the key ones. I think when we were, so we got to profitability in 2017, about 2.5 years after I got there. And in 2018, we got an inbound from one of the big tech companies. They wanted to buy us. And we ran a process, and it was through that process where, again, it was like this inflection point. And my sense was like, I don't want to pull the ripcord on this yet. I don't want to just go be absorbed and get off this path that we're on. We have so much more work to do, so much more opportunity and potential. So I think that was another inflection point, finding the right partner. And so for us, I was familiar with VC and obviously like strategic acquirers. I had never heard of this category of growth equity, and our bankers thankfully tuned me into that. And so we're able to find this like little niche category of folks who saw Altros through the exact same lens that we do, which is like, this can be a global platform. Like, we really have an opportunity to do this thing at scale and make a positive impact. And so we found the absolute right partner in Spectrum Equity. So that's another one. When you have the wrong financial partner, it is so hard to unwind it. It's impossible. It's impossible to unwind it. And so finding the right partner, that was a huge, there's no way, I can definitively say this, there's no way we'd be where we are today without Spectrum Equity and the partnership that they've had and support and everything else. So that's definitely an inflection point. There's so many along the way. I think that early on, that's really what set us on this trajectory.
That's really interesting because you brought on 2015, hey, grow this thing and flip it. 2018, you get an offer from a major tech company. That's probably very tempting, probably means some good financial return for you and for many others. That's really interesting. You turn that down, you do the growth equity. I'm not fully familiar with growth equity. Is that debt financing? Is that?
No, they buy us. They buy us out. And it's like we clean the cap table and it's a new chapter, a new start. And every employee gets equity like any other startup. The difference is that in the VC game, you tend to get, if you're doing multiple rounds, which once you're on that VC path, you're stuck, like continuing down that path. And every time you
do round, is it a down round?
And every time you do a raise, it's from a new capital partner and they're joining the board. And next thing you know, you have 4, 5, 6 different VCs with misaligned incentives. We could do a whole podcast on why I don't like the VC model. With private equities, it's super clean. It's super clean. And so Spectrum bought us, two of them on the board and me, and they're like, let's get you some strategic partners, some advisors that can really help you on this journey. And so we went, got the former CEO of Ancestry.com. We got the CEO of Robinhood on our board, just really surrounding ourselves with amazing operators and financial partners. And it's really clean. We're all on the same side of the table. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I can't say enough good things about this model, honestly.
Cool. So let's get into the weeds a little bit. What are some of the key sources of your growth? Clearly, you were on the organic growth path initially. Then you obviously got some financing. Did you turn to paid? To what degree? And how has that changed over the years to today?
So I guess there's a couple different layers. First is through the lens of like product market fit, product channel fit. And so the subscription model, when I started, there's 20,000 subscribers. It was really small. And I didn't have any familiarity with subscription businesses. I had done marketplaces. I had done sell to small businesses. I'd done ad supported businesses, but the power, the leverage of a subscription model when done right is unlike anything else that I've seen in my career. So that was a big driver of growth, like really leaning into this subscription business and creating value and retention and everything else. And then product channel fit. And so we also has been around since 2010. It started as a website. And so we had just a ton of really strong legacy SEO. And that was a tremendous source of just free organic traffic, millions of people a month. And so that gave us the opportunity, especially in the early days, we're trying to get to profitability. We didn't have to worry about user acquisition because they were coming top of the funnel. We just had to unlock the funnel itself. So that was a really wonderful dynamic. But as we've grown, then the growth vectors changed a little bit, right? And so SEO is great. We still continue to invest in SEO, but there's obviously like risks inherent with building on a platform that you don't control. And so the diversification of channels, and some through sweat equity, some through paid acquisition, like you said, we had never actually done paid acquisition. We've never spent a dime on paid acquisition until 2018. And so again, all of that growth prior to that was just organic. And there's SEO, there's ASO, app store optimization, really trying to think through again, like no cost or incredibly low cost ways of getting traffic to our platform. And then paid acquisition comes in the mix and figure out how to scale that, how to do channel diversification. And I'd say the place we're at today is obviously those are all still happening. But I think that the real growth levers in front of us are really, it's product driven growth. That's why like I said, when I started, we had 6 people. We're over 200 people today. The big thrust of that is through the lens of product development and just trying to build more faster, create value, unlock virality, everything else that comes with product-driven growth. In addition to that, marketing-driven growth, as I mentioned earlier, trying to build a global brand that stands for something. And there's a lot of sub-dimensions to both of those. And then international expansion too. We want to build a global community. And so how do we take the traction that we've started with in North America and start rolling it out around the globe? So we've got our hands full. And this is what's nice at this phase in our company's trajectory. We're a little bit better able to balance short versus medium versus long-term initiatives and investments. And that's been nice. It's a lot of fun and hopefully ensures our success for the long haul.
It's really interesting that you're talking about building a global brand because, of course, you're super strong in North America, but people travel. So even if it's just for your core audience, people travel and they go somewhere and they want to check where are the trails, where do I go, what do I do? But it's almost impossible to build up what you've got in North America without actually building up local experts who say, hey, this is great. This is a difficult trail. This is an easy trail. This took me 4 hours up and 3 hours back or something like that, right? So all that stuff requires local communities. Super interesting. Continuing on the growth story, was there one source of growth that you completely lucked into? You talked about the SEO and you had the website and that was great and you had that organic traffic. Was there anything else as you were an app and as you were growing that you just, whoa, why'd we have 100,000 new users yesterday or something like that?
There's a lot of luck along the way, for sure. For sure. I would actually say the first thing is just stumbling onto this subscription-driven business model. Because again, I had no familiarity with it whatsoever. And it was only after I got here that I recognized the leverage that it can provide. So I think that was the first just stroke of good luck. And then there's stuff along the way, right? Getting a nice write-up in XYZ publication, the first few times you get app of the day, it's a really, really big deal. Especially when you're young or when you're on the early part of your career, this huge spike that can provide is a really cool feeling. Through the lens of international expansion, when you just start seeing a market, just like the flywheel click in. And so it's like, oh my gosh, like we have traction in Australia and Ireland and France. I mean, things like that. It's not always on your radar. You want to think that everything you're doing is always proactive and intentional. Sometimes luck happens and you back into something.
As you're building out growth strategies and tactics, was there one that completely fell flat? The balloon just popped. It did nothing.
Yeah. We've been playing mistakes along the way, to be clear. And that's what kind of makes this fun. There's no playbook for what we're doing. And that's what means that there's an opportunity here. And one of our core cultural tenets is to embrace failure when we see it, right? Because that's how we get stronger, we get smarter. It directly contributes to our growth. So there's plenty of examples, hypotheses just that did not pan out. One in particular that I take full credit for the failure is a referral program, which again, on paper sounds so good and examples all over. I was of the opinion, because we're so mission driven and I didn't want a referral program to be commercial or transactional. I didn't want to be like invite X number of people to All Trails, you get Y months or Y years of All Trails Plus, or you get credit to our merch store. I was really adamant that this should be altruistic. And so we did a tree planting campaign. So if I went and brought John into the platform, All Trails would plant 2 trees, one for me and one for John. I was convinced that we were going to plant 1 million trees in a year. I was convinced that this thing was going to just take off like wildfire, and it did not. And that's on me. That's all right, right? This is all part of it. You test stuff out, fail fast, and then learn. Don't make the same mistakes over and over again.
Does it get harder to be willing to fail as you get bigger? When you're 6 people, when you're 15 people, nobody knows about you. You can fail in the dark. It's all good. When you're the app of the year and you try something, there's potential to be more public about that failure. Is that something that restrains you from taking some of those big swings, or does it change the way you take risks with a small percentage of your users? Talk about that.
This is where core values and like cultural tenets and everything else like really come into play. And one of the fascinating things is we scale. We had 30 people at the start of the pandemic. We doubled headcount year over year. And we're bringing people from all sorts of different companies. And what we found was like, there are certain bigger companies specifically where folks were just trained to be more risk averse for exactly what you're just saying, right? And so we had to get in front of that and just, again, be really proactive about what does it mean to work here? And at Alltrails, it's all about momentum. It's all about momentum. We can't let perfect get in the way of good. We're going to embrace our failures. Sometimes you have to move forward when there isn't statistical significance or like clear-cut research. We kind of have to trust our intuition or our gut sometimes. The key thing, again, is momentum. That is like my finger on the pulse is through the lens of momentum. Momentum begets momentum. And for a company like ours, momentum is our lifeblood. But and momentum is, to be clear, also is like fully intertwined with culture. Like one does not happen with the other. And at the same time, like you lose sight of either of those slip away, it is nearly impossible to regain them. And so it's very important to me that we hold on to this kind of startup ethos, like bias towards action, forward progress. Let's not get too precious with anything. We need to go fast. And so I don't think we're becoming more risk averse. Things get a little bit more complicated. You have more departments and there's externalities and things like that. But that's why I think, honestly, like one of the biggest like levers for growth is process design. And as like lame and boring as that sounds, you can hire the best people in the world. You add all this mass, but if you don't create the system for velocity around them, you lose your momentum. And so I think so much of our ability to just be fast is a mindset. And then making sure that we're like really being honest with the way in which we're operating internally so that people can move fast and with autonomy and agency, but still within like the guardrails of our strategy.
It's the first time I've been talking to people in the mobile app space about growth, and they've said one of the core levers of growth is process design. But when you talk about team, when you talk about culture, when you talk about momentum and sustaining that, not just for a week, not just for a month or 1 year, but over the course of a decade, longer, it makes sense. If you have a culture that does that, if you have people that do that, if you have processes that enable that, absolutely. It almost makes me wonder about still not being afraid to fail. If you should almost have like a KPI around that. What did you fail on this year? If you didn't fail on anything, clearly you weren't aiming high enough. You didn't take enough risks. I don't know if anybody's put that into their KPIs or their year end, but I wonder if it should be. I wanted to ask about paid user acquisition versus organic. What have you learned? It's interesting as I listen to your story, because usually those people who come to you in the beginning, those might be your best customers ever because they're your core demo. They find you because they're looking for something like you. And then when you start paid acquisition, then you're reaching a little outside and hopefully you're reaching people who still want you and need you, but just haven't heard of you. But eventually you start reaching out as well to people who, you know, oh, wow, this sounds, you know, so it becomes harder sometimes, right, to scale. What have you learned about the differences between paid user acquisition versus organic user acquisition?
They are certainly both your own beast and they're fluid. You think you have it figured out and then something changes year over year, right? So on the organic side, it's kind of like there's these like competing poles that are going on. We keep making investments and, for example, let's say SEO, right? There's technical SEO and all the UGC and different front end frameworks, whatever. And we can keep going up, but then at the same time, like the Google or whoever can achieve their SERP and be pushing us down the page. And so it's a give and take, right? And so there's no such thing as like, it's not static. By any means, super fluid. I'd say the app store optimization too, it's constantly changing. And so I think that's just part of our approach is having this like this learner's mindset, this like we haven't beat it, like we have to keep investing, we have to keep revisiting. So on the organic side, there's a lot there. On the paid side, it's similar, right? You look at the world of paid acquisition in 2016, 17, 18, whatever, and like how it unlocked all these D2C companies like the golden era of D2C, and then Facebook, Instagram, or whatever will change their algorithm, change the cost per install or cost click, whatever. And something like businesses would tank overnight, right? or like Apple goes and changes the way that privacy and IDFA and everything there. And so all of it is just, it's super fluid. The tooling is changing. Now AI is changing everything too. It's like, it's just going to continue to evolve. And so I think just like, I don't know, it's kind of like riding a wave or whatever. Like it's very dynamic underfoot, and you have to stay balanced. And like, I don't know, you can't just be like rigid static and expect that like you're going to crack the code. Sometimes you have to pull back on one and you try and do it another. And then obviously there's all these new channels. So even from like a paid acquisition perspective, podcasts or TikTok or even like programmatic TV and the way that you can run it as a direct response channel too. So, you know, test, be fluent. Some things will be able to pour more gas on. Sometimes you have to like pull back from stuff, but you're always revisiting assumptions.
Absolutely true. I noticed when I was looking at your app before we chatted that you update the app about every 11 days. That seems high. And I didn't do a study to confirm that that is high, but I'm just thinking more common is about a month or every couple of months or something like that. Maybe a little more frequently for some of the real fast changing games or something. Is regularly updating your app and doing it so frequently, is that relevant to your growth story, do you think?
Absolutely. That's very intentional. And the reason why is, aside from our employees, our single biggest asset is our community, right? Like AllTrails is nothing without our community. And I think about this relationship, the dynamic, like why do communities ebb and flow? Why do once vibrant communities suddenly disappear? Sometimes it keeps me up at night. But I think that there's a lot of different reasons. But I think one of the key things, because it is a symbiotic relationship, again, our community members, our users are taking time to invest content within our platform. They're leaving reviews for other trail goers. They're adding photos. They're emailing us with new trails that we should have on our platform. They're emailing us with product feedback and ideas. It's a very vibrant and active community. And so in return, our obligation to them is to demonstrate our investment as well. We need to keep making it. Like I said earlier with momentum, like it's all about momentum. It's all about continual forward progress. We need to keep adding value in for our end users, both in front and behind the paywall, right? But continue to invest in free features, reduce friction, make it more intuitive, make it more lovable. And so it's very important to us that our community members know and recognize and feel that we are investing heavily into the product experience. And in return, as they invest UGC within our platform. And it's this beautiful symbiotic relationship, but it is predicated on continual product development and continual improvement.
Let's end here. Somebody looks at you, they see what you've built. They see 2023 iPhone app of the year, they want to be there. Of course, that's a fool's errand. You can't guarantee all that stuff. Everything is changeable and there's only one iPhone app of the year. So that's a really hard target to hit. But somebody says, I'm going to go for that. What's your advice to them?
I'd say surround yourself with people smarter than you. Surround yourself with people smarter than you and then stay humble so that you're actually like open to receiving their advice.
Countercultural advice in this era of hard charging CEOs.
I know.
Command and conquer CEOs, wartime CEOs.
I swear, I've seen more startups fail because of hubris and stubbornness of the CEO and just like running their idea without making adjustments. I mean, even when it's clear as day and they just run it into the ground, I see it all the time. And again, it's ego. Right. Like, so I think that's the thing, right? Like, supplicate your ego. It's not about you. It's about doing the right thing. It's about the product. It's about your community. And you need third party perspectives. You need guidance. You need people telling you what you don't see or what you don't know. And so again, the single best way to do that is just surround yourself with really smart, passionate, kind people and stay humble.
Sweet. We cannot see our own blind spots. That is the nature of a blind spot. And we don't know everything we need to know in order to be successful. Whatever our job is, things are changing too fast and too many places. Ron, thank you so much for this time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.